afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to the Ultimate Men's Summit. We've been on a really extraordinary and deep journey already, and I just encourage you to download the recordings of the calls you've missed. It's been very rich. Gay Hendricks and Arjuna Arda over lunch today. Some really fascinating insights as a result of their Dear Woman video. Anyway, we'll have many more to come in the days ahead. So, and in the next 45 minutes, we're going to get a chance to go deeper with one of the real pioneers of the men's movement and a psychologist and leading-edge thinker and author, Sam Keen. He, in his own words, he was overeducated at Harvard and Princeton and is a professor of philosophy and religion at various legitimate institutions and a contributing editor of Psychology Today for 20 years before going freelance. He's a thinker, seminar leader, and consultant, and author of many books, including Fire in the Belly on Being a Man, which is probably his most famous in the men's arena, and he's the co-producer of an award-winning PBS documentary called Faces of the Enemy. And on others' fronts, he's actually, when he's not traveling and lecturing, he's a works with a flying trapeze. So a very fascinating and eclectic background. Welcome, Sam Keen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great. Well, why don't you, since you've seen a lot of the men's movement over the years, I'd love for just to start with some of your reflections on the first kind of awakening of the need for a men's movement, maybe where things evolved in positive directions, where things evolved in not so positive directions, and maybe what do you see as the leading edge now?
Well, maybe I should talk about that personally. It's the easiest way to get into it. I think many men were shocked by the whole emergence of feminism, by Betty Friedan's the feminine mystique and all of the various feminist literature. It shocked us because we considered ourselves the norms, and we considered that we would define woman as we wanted to, and here they were coming up and saying, you know, this is not who we are. This is a caricature. This is the way that the patriarchy has portrayed women. And it was, for most men, I think, a rather unpleasant realization. I won't even say realization, an unpleasant charge. For those of us who opened ourselves to that and sort of like gulped and says, oh my God, it's true, you know. And we tried to adjust our attitudes. We tried to stop being so chauvinistic and realize the ways in which really manhood in this culture had been a privilege that was and had rights and that women did not enjoy. Sometime after that, I think it occurred to us. It certainly occurred to me that it was also true that men were not the way that they had been described by our culture. I started in with a men's group. We got a group of men together, and we began to meet. And most of the thing is we were complaining about the women in our lives or not in our lives. But gradually we got around to looking at the ways in which the culture had defined us and how we, most of us felt we really couldn't measure up to this kind of macho image of what a man was supposed to be, always rough and tough and in power, and especially, you know, keeping control over the environment, keeping control over women. That wasn't our way, and that we weren't fearless, and that we had a whole lot of clandestine emotions that weren't supposed to belong to men. And it was out of that experience that I wrote the book Fire in the Belly. And it came as quite a shock to me that I suddenly was supposedly one of the inventors of the men's movement, because I'd never been to any of these large seminars. Robert Bly and Moore were conducting these very large things in which they were reinitiating men, supposedly, with drumming and all of that. Mine was a much more approach that came much more from my work in mythology. Work with Joseph Campbell and I did seminars together for years and years and years, and all of the foundation of my work has been in looking at what mythology is, about the stories that we tell ourselves and the way in which those stories are superimposed upon our own experience of life, so that we're all we're all, as it were, brainwashed, that a whole set of values and a whole worldview is downloaded into us before we are able to make any kind of conscious evaluation of our experience of life. And this was true. This was true about our views of manhood. It's also certainly in a more, destructive way, true of the way in which we see other people, of our enemies. And we create a whole mythology of enmity, and we create whole faces of the enemy. And so that's what came out of that. And I think that my experience in that way was common. As a matter of fact, I think that the reason that the fire in the belly was such a success, and it was a success, I mean, suddenly I was able to put the shingles on my house, quite literally. And it was a success is because it spoke this truth that men had not spoken out loud. And so one of the most endearing experiences I had during that period was men would come up to me, and some of them almost in tears. I mean, I remember one man, he said, you are my words. You're saying what I've never been able to find the words to say. And that was about the vulnerability of men. And so I think there was that period, and some of it got a little silly, I have to say. Some of it began to think that you could initiate people by weekends or drumming or, you know, Indian rituals or things of that kind. And they didn't take seriously the ways in which men were already initiated in our culture, because it's not true that we don't have rites of initiation. We have them. They're just very secular and can be very destructive, as, for instance, war has always been a mode of initiation and training the male to be a warrior, which you don't have to have gone to war to have been subjected to that kind of training. You're taught, you know, a man is rough and tough and hard to bluff, and the kind of model would be Gary Cooper in High Noon. You know, we stand alone, we're fearless, all of that kind of thing. So we tried, I think, the men's movement tried in a fairly naive way to think that they could change all of that by making up rituals. And I think it's a bad idea. I was talking to my son this morning, and he said, you know, Dad, how many fathers and sons have the kind of thing that we do, that we can say anything to each other? And that I consider that he is a well-initiated young man, not because we did any kind of rituals, but because we have, through the years, we have talked, we have wrestled with each other, we have fought, we have gone through things. And one of the most wonderful experiences of my entire life was when I fell and I had this subdural hematoma, and I had three surgeries, and he came to the hospital, and he said, Dad, he said, and you know, we'd had our share of fighting and disagreement and his disappointment, that thing, and he just said, Dad, there's no other way to say this, but I just want you to know that the statute of limit, whatever I thought I had against you, the statute of limitations has run out. Well, that was the moment where his initiation in that sense was complete. We had wrestled through things. We had wrestled through all of that necessary conflict between a father and a son to come to the point where we had forgiven each other and could talk freely about anything. That's a mode of initiation. And the deeper kinds of changes that needed to be made, we didn't make. They were political changes. And in that sense, the 60s and the protests of the 60s were much more virile than what happened in the men's movement in the 90s. They took on that machine, which conditions us year after year after year to be in the world as warriors, And that's an unfinished piece of business. So I think that after this, the mythopoetic, which I never was a part of, I don't really like it very much because I never believed that there were archetypes, and the idea, you know, that Moore and those put across that there were these archetypes of warrior and magician and lover. What was the other one? Anyway, the idea that those were archetypes, I just think that's wrong. If you had to choose an archetype for male in the Western world, it would be citizen. That's what we got from Aristotle and Plato and Socrates. So I think that after that, it began to disintegrate. There was the whole thing of the metrosexual, of the man asserting their right to pleasure, to preening, to sort of what happened when Gentlemen's Quarterly took over the men's movement, you know, and I remember Art, what was his name? Anyway, the editor of the thing, who had parodied the men's movement, just said, you know, well, here's what a man he's got an Armani suit and a whatever kind of shirt, and he's got a pocket full of money, you know, and he's sure of himself. And so there was a lot of just the commercialization of the movement. And then after 9/11, there was the backlash of suddenly we were, you know, the motto was a hard man is good to find. We want these masculine heroes. We want the firefighters. We want the military who's going into Iraq and all of that. They're the new heroes. And I think that in that sense, the whole movement has kind of petered out now. It's waiting for a rebirth. That's where I think.
And what do you think is essential to create that kind of a rebirth? What is it that might have been missing in those earlier waves that would infuse more authentic power and juice into a men's movement?
Well, in the first place, I hope the men's movement is dead. I think that just as feminism in that sense is dead. I don't think you can tell me one thing about femininity that I haven't heard 5,000 times. I think the same thing about, quote, masculinity. To focus on the problem of women is just as wrong as to focus on the problem of men. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't battles to be fought. Women have got a lot of battles to fight still to find equality. But those are political battles. They're not theoretical battles. They're getting women in the legislatures, getting them out, getting equal pay, and things that are beginning to happen. In other words, the women's movement is not going to find its strength in creating a new set of ideas or analysis of patriarchy or anything of the kind. They're going to find it in action in the political world and in the economic and social world. The same thing, I think, is true of men. Now, we've won the right to be more emotional, and now it's time to get on with something else. And the first thing I would say, I want to see the revolutionary movement to be a thing for people. Not for men and women, but for persons. And to put it this way, the problems that the world is facing, the problems that we must become heroic in order to wrestle with, are problems which are equally present for men and for women. We are equally challenged, and we are challenged in the same way to rise to the same occasions in the same way. So manhood and womanhood and womanhood in the past has always been defined politically, and manhood has been defined in terms of that warrior motion, warrior mythology largely, and women in terms of nurture and childbearing and things of that kind. We're in a different age now. We're in an age where women are just as important in the public realm. In other words, in the old thing, women were supposed to be in the private realm, and men took care of the public realm. That's not true anymore. And also, even the problems that we face are not local problems. They're international problems. So in the sense that in the past there was always a kind of heroic, no, there was a heroic kind of man, and that was the man who rose to the occasion and confronted the danger of that era. So you go back, and the earliest kinds of models we have of manhood were hunters. They were the ones who had the sensitivity and the ability to go out and to kill the eland and feed the tribe, and the hunter who could get the game and who was generous in sharing that with the tribe. That was a man. That was a real man. Now, that later came, as we came into another time in history, it came in terms of the farming economy and all of that. That changed it. And then that changed again the image. So then you had the male and the female identifying more with the cycle of the seasons. And that's the kind of model that you get in Plato and Aristotle, as well as in traditional cultures, where the soul is like the changing of the seasons. It goes through these heroic cycles of birth and maturation and of decline and of death and then of rebirth, which is essentially the hero's journey. And then all that changed. Christianity had brought in another view, as did Buddhism, and where the whole idea not of being a warrior, that wasn't what made a real man. What made a real man in both Christianity and in Buddhism was two virtues of wisdom and compassion. That was what was expected. And then, you know, we go up into the Industrial Revolution, and you got Homo faber, and it was the man who can make things and who can produce things. And, you know, Henry Ford was the model. And then, you know, we change. So every era has its changing enthusiasm, its changing challenges, and its changing image of what it means to be a man and a woman. And until our time, those were different images. And what I'm saying now is that time is over. We are in a time now where the major challenges that face us in terms of our survival are not genderly based at all.
That's a fascinating tour of history and insights there. And I'm curious, so if we're often driven by these collective images of the kind of the ideals that we hold, and that so much of the inherited images that we have for the masculine is defined by an enemy or protecting from, you know, right, some perceived enemy, that then we're really faced with a world in which that enemy psychology is no longer that worthwhile for the most part. How do we go beyond it?
When I did the film Faces of the Enemy, we interviewed a man at the Naval College in Rhode Island. Very, very interesting. He says, you don't just have to accept any enemy that shows up, you know. Choose your enemies well. And what he was telling us was that Vietnam was a terrible choice of enemies, you know. And you look at where we are now, we hardly know which enemy to choose and which one not to, you know. We hardly know whether the overthrow of the government in Mubarak in Egypt, was that good or was it bad? I mean, now the generals are back in charge, and what do we do if we get rid of Gaddafi? And to say nothing, you know, of the situation in Iran or Syria. So, you know, we're like warriors now, charging around, like my mother used to say, climb on a horse and charge off in all directions. You know, the military model is still absorbing a majority of our investments, but it's obsolete. It's obsolete. We can't. I mean, just recently, I mean, within 5 years, the whole idea of a Pax Americana, that we were going to be the number one superpower, and therefore that our military had to be able to control things anywhere in the world. That idea is dead and gone. It's just not buried. But you look and that now we're supplying, what is it, American taxpayer, 70% of NATO's budget. NATO is not doing very well in terms of getting rid of Gaddafi, and you know, we're in a world where economically India and China are apt to be eating our lunch very quickly. So, you know, we're called on to make these radical changes, and changes which are fueled by the ecological crisis that we're all in, and the decline in availability of energy and of water and of clean air and all of that. That's the challenge of our time. Now, I don't see how you could create a movement that's about virility in man or about power in women that didn't address itself directly to those questions.
So in a way, if your core thesis there is that we define the masculine by confronting the danger of the times, it's like we actually need more of an eco-hero now than we...
Exactly, and when you put it that way, you realize, well, but wait a minute, then there's no difference between the challenge for men or women, is there, in this age?
Uh-huh.
Huh. Yeah,
right.
Exactly, you got it. So, you know, this calls for a kind of reconciliation. This calls for a lot of work, because I don't know that we're yet ready to give up the war between the sexes. As a matter of fact, we're not. I mean, one of the things that's quite disgusting is men behaving badly. Far from men, far from having major models of wisdom and compassion. Now, we do have them. I'm not saying that, but we have pretty horrible models in the last month or two. Arnold Schwarzenegger, what he's been about, and Strauss Kahn, and Wiener, and John Edwards. I mean, these are the actions of these people make you ashamed to be a man. They say, what the hell kind of image were they dealing with? I mean, these were men that we had, in one way or another, granted power, granted influence, granted our affections, and they act like fraternity boys on a drunk.
Hmm. One thing that Michael Dowd was pointing out yesterday, he's very into studying the interface of science and religion and evolution. And he was just pointing out how when there's a change in status, that the testosterone levels just automatically take a big jump. And so that it was kind of interesting just how our own biological drives make it more challenging as these political leaders with more and more power to contain, control, and channel.
Wait, but say that again.
They've done some studies that when there's a change in status, let's say you're promoted from director at a company to president,
yeah.
Then there's an automatic testosterone surge that accompanies that change in status, just based upon our kind of primate ancestry. And so anyway, it's a factor when we think about, like, how do we deal with men in powerful situations who are then acting badly?
Yeah, well, that's one of my the kind of meta thesis and the thing that I've worked on a lot. I've got an essay that's on my website on the sacred, the nature of the sacred and profane power, and we have tended to think that if you gave up that profane power, that power over the thing like that's expressed in all four of these men, that you're left with something wimpy. Well, it isn't true. There's a sacred power as well as a profane power, and it defines our lives quite differently, but quite differently, as a matter of fact.
How do you differentiate between the sacred power and the profane power in your work?
Well, first, like, I just call your attention to the essay, because it's quite an intricate thing. But to start, just let me just trot out the list a little bit, and then you see what it means. Profane power is always willful. It's focused on achievement. It's goal oriented. It's always individual power. It's my power. It's kind of testosterone driven. It specializes in speed. You know, do it now, quickly, quickly, quickly. That's not fast enough. That kind of power is always a possession. It's always a zero sum game. If I win, you have to lose. And that kind of power we think of, it's diminished if I have to share it. It's individualistic. It always seeks the domination of other people. And it's about coercion. It separates me from you. And it demands conformity. And that kind of power is always used to gain more power. And that kind of power also always depends upon mystification, upon, you know, what Dostoevsky talked about of miracle, mystery, and authority. It hypnotizes us, and it's neurotic. It's always seeking a vindictive triumph. Now, the other sacred power, and we're not used to thinking of this as power, but this goes back to the Greeks and the idea that sacred power is essentially erotic. It is our being drawn towards something which is good, beautiful, and true. So sacred power is something which is evoked. It's always a gift. So look at I like George O'Keefe. Look at George O'Keefe. Look at that kind of power, the power of her art. It was a gift to her. She wouldn't say, oh, I achieved this. No, it was a gift. So sacred power also is when we define ourselves vocationally. Here's what I am called to become. It's also communal, and it involves a community. In the old sense of the word, it's enthusiastic. That is, that word just means that you're filled with spirit or filled with Zeus, or it's charismatic. That kind of power is very rhythmic. It bides its time. You know, that lovely little book on Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, he describes him coming out of the forest after meditating all those years, and then he wants a job, you know, sort of the Bank of America job of his time. And they say to him, well, you don't have any credentials for this. He says, oh, yes, I do. I've been in the forest. I can think. I can fast. I can wait. That sense of biding your time is that's the basis of wisdom. And that kind of power is responsible to others. And it's always a win-win game. And that kind of power, you increase it by sharing it. So instead of being individualistic, it's intersubjective. Instead of seeking domination over others, it seeks the fulfillment of the neighbor. And it doesn't coerce, it invites. It doesn't separate, it unites. And instead of creating conformity, it creates diversity. And it's not used to gain more power, that kind of sacred power is used to gain more justice. And, it's erotic, it seeks to enjoy others rather than to triumph over them. So that
beautiful distinctions you're making and very poetic. And I'm curious, since you talked about the relationship with your son and how fulfilled it is at this point without a lot of the traditional kind of initiatory rituals or rites of passage. And, you know, how do we, since as youth are growing up and they're not necessarily inculcated with that sense of sacred power, what can we do as adult men to help to empower a next generation of men with more of that sense of a sacred power?
Well, sacred power, the sense of sacred power is not taught, it's caught. In that way, the old shaman and thing was right. You catch it from somebody who's got it. You say, wait, you sense the people who are living that way, and you put yourself next to them. You study them. Like, one of my great, great teachers in life was Howard Thurman. He was a black mystic, and I ran into him when I was at Harvard. He was at Boston University, and he was sort of the guardian of my soul. He was the one that said that famous line in The Fire in the Belly. He says, well, Sam, man has to ask himself two questions. You know, where am I going, and who will go with me? And then he says, if you ever get those in the wrong order, you're in big trouble. And he was telling me I was in big trouble. I just run off with a young and foxy person, and she, as a matter of fact, had just run off with a poet, and he was a bad poet, I'm happy to say. And anyway, and so, you know, you don't pick a particular area of your life and try to learn what it's like to live in terms of the sacred emotions. This is the main thing that I do in this book, In the Absence of God and Dwelling in the Presence of the Sacred. I say to define what it means to to live in with this sense of what your life is about, of and in every way, you know, starting instead of just with curiosity, starting with wonder in the sense of, you know, why is there something rather than anything? It's what philosophy starts in and ends in, as well as authentic religion and the sense of awe and the sense of that your life is a gift and sense of gratitude and sense of compassion and of some vocation to increase the sacredness of the world. So you can't just say, well, I'm going to try to apply or make myself available to the experience of the sacred with regard to my manhood or my sexuality. No, it has to be everything. Everything. So, you know, here, I'll give you a little example, a very simple example. So I'm in the checkout line in my local grocery store. And the woman at the checkout girl is just diddling around. I don't know what she's doing, diddling around, you know. And I say something like, come on, you know, I don't have all day. And then I look for the first time. I really look at her, and I see, you know, I see that when I said that, she sort of muscles on her neck grab up a little bit. I can see that it was a little hurt. It was hurtful to say that, and I just suddenly realized what I've done. You know, it's a little cruelty. Just I've treated her like a thing. Like a machine that's not working. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I'm just grouchy today. And then she said, I know. She said, I feel kind of that way myself. Now, there, in essence, is what it means to change from a secular, functional way of dealing with others. What Martin Buber says, I was dealing with her in the beginning like an it. She was an it, and she was out of place in my world. And then when I suddenly, and you know, there's nothing very mysterious about it. I just looked and listened, and first place I felt empathy. I said, oh yeah, I know that. And then I felt sympathy. Well, all that that takes just paying attention and being open. So to live in the presence of the sacred requires thousand acts in any given week. Little tiny things like that, whether you're dealing with yourself, with your child, or whatever else, of stop, look, listen, remember what a wondrous place you are in, and how you have no idea how you got here or where you're going, but you're, by golly, you got this, and it was given to you. And that's true of other people, too. And other people suffer just like you do. You know, like the Buddha says, first of all, of the noble truth, that means spiritual truth, is that life's suffering. You know, that girl was suffering, too. That woman was suffering, just like I was. And instead of going first to her suffering in compassion, I went to using her as a target for my own daily frustrations.
It's a great story, and yeah, it really does boil down to those simple things. And one thing, you've written some about this notion of how important sacrifice is, which is very connected etymologically with sacred, and just wondering, what do you see the role of, like, embracing sacrifice as part of this sacred power for men?
Well, that's always a question, which is, in some way or another, entrance into the world of the sacred. What are you willing to sacrifice? For what would you sacrifice your time, your money, your energy, your life? In my work on war and all that, I have another essay I wrote on death myths and how in our culture we don't have any concept of dying for something. We have something dying from something. And the only... So I will often ask an audience, I say, you know, you just finish this sentence for me. He died for. The audience is always dominantly going to say his country. She died for her children. So the truth is that to create anything of value requires a sacrifice. to have a child, to care for that child involves the sacrifice of a lot of my time, of my energy, and my money, and my attention. If I want to produce a work of art, I have to do that. I have to make the same kind of commitment. For instance, if I really want to write something, I've got to sit down. I've got to pay my dues. I've got to study the stuff. I've got to work on it. So, wonderful little book, Milton Merhoff's book on caring, shows what it means to care of and take care of an idea of somebody else and of yourself. So that kind of we mythologize sacrifice in a way that's very difficult to deal with. So like now we talk about the troops who have sacrificed their lives in Iraq, and it's very hard to speak out against that, because the truth is, once they're there and in that system, it's absolutely true. They're getting killed, but they're getting killed for a bad war. They're getting killed for a kind of foreign policy which does Vietnam once again. And so it's very, there's, you know, how would you rather, by what sacrifice would you like to be defined? And how would you like to define courage and all of that? Well, there is military courage, and the people who are on the front lines there, I stand in awe of how they can do that without disintegrating psychologically, and especially when the wars that we're fighting are more and more questionable in terms of any hope of peace coming out of it.
Well, let's get to the question.
Sacrifice is what we do to create value.
That's a beautiful definition. It really makes a lot of sense. So let's get some questions from the audience. If you're on
let me say one more thing, okay?
Sure. Go for it.
Because I want to talk about heroes just a minute, who the real heroes are. There are a lot of heroes and heroines, and we just don't notice them. Paul Hawken wrote a marvelous book called Blessed Unrest. And in that book, he says, you know, we're undergoing the biggest social revolution we've ever had, and nobody notices it. And he deals with the NGOs, the non-government organizations. Now, you want to see heroic action. And anonymous, I don't even know the name of a person I could tell you, but go to Doctors Without Borders. Go to Amnesty International. Go to Save the Children. Go to Heifers International. Those just being the four of the ones that I most admire and support. And there are now thousands and thousands and thousands of these people who have dedicated themselves to just saying, look, you know, governments aren't doing these things. We're going to do them. And they work anonymously, and they give their lives all over. That's the new heroic men and women, the most heroic men and women that we see, who are making those kinds of sacrifices, and you know, for to end human hunger, to end Nile River disease, or whatever it is that's a problem out there. There's a volunteer group that just grab and grab can, we used to say in wrestling. You know, they're grab and can like that, and they're not waiting around for experts to tell them what to do. Like the kids who said, look, our government's ignoring Darfur. Let's get on the computer and get that going. Or they did the same thing with landmines. You know, the government wasn't doing it. So a bunch of damn kids with computers did it. And, you know, that's the one of the major directions of heroic action in now and in the future.
That speaks right back to what you said earlier about the hero confronts the challenge of the day, and so if the challenges are social, environmental, and economic, that's the real heroism of today.
Exactly, and it would be an incredible mistake not to put theirs right in the center of our focus. And so that's one thing I a little bit worry about this resurgence of interest in the men's movement and things like that. Now, I don't want a men's movement. Forget a men's movement. Find out how to help people get into those kinds of situations where they can do a lot of good and where it takes a lot of courage and a lot of sacrifice to do it.
Great. So if you have a question for Sam, touch 1 on your keypad if you're on the live line, or you can type it into the webcast as well.
Or if you have an answer, type 2.
That's funny. So let's go to Harvey. You're live.
Hi, Sam. I really, really applaud what you said about human consciousness as being the real crisis of today. My question is about the profane power. Have you done any research into the percentage of people who are in that profane power group who are sociopaths and psychopaths, and how our society is actually helping them develop themselves into more powerful than anybody else on this planet?
Yeah, that's a nice question. Well, I tell you what I can be sure of. There are none of the sociopaths that are in the sacred power.
Correct.
Although there are a lot of them who misuse sacred power. A lot of gurus. I mean, there's a lot of very bad crap going on with the guru. There always is. Gurus are heavily into power and heavily into denying it. You know, I interviewed all those people in Psychology Today days, you know, to see what they. So. If somebody wants to have spiritual power over you, you better take a close look. Now, but I don't think you find those who are in the people who are genuinely looking for a sacred way of living. But you're absolutely right that there are a lot of sociopaths in charge of Fortune 500 companies.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also some that are not. I mean, look at Warren Buffett and Bill Gates who are giving billions of what they've earned to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't have to be a sociopath to be a success in business, but sometimes it helps.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harvey. Let's go to James. You're live.
Hi. I enjoy your discussion. I'm just wondering, you have a great historical perspective. Is humanity's ability to rise beyond their own individual struggles a function of how well they're taken care of individually? I mean, it seems to me that there's just a lot of turmoil in our country, particularly economically, politically, a lot of relationship issues. I mean,
I don't think so. I think that's too simple. Because if you look at, look at Bushman culture. Or look at most traditional cultures. In most traditional cultures, the group was prior to the individual, and the preservation of the commons was everybody's responsibility. So people are have been able to identify with the group even in the worst of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very strange thing. See that now we have, in some ways, we have the best of circumstances. That we're in America, in spite of 9% unemployment and all of that, the majority of people in this country have a lot of stuff. You just ride downtown and look at that, and you ask yourself, well, is this a poor and suffering country? And it's not if we shared what we have, it isn't. So it's not the chaos. How to put this? What we used to say, it's not the dog and the size of the dog in the fight, but the size of the fight and the dog. It's not the amount of chaos. It is how a community deals with that chaos.
Right. Think about divorce rates. I mean, and the impact that has on individuals. I mean, not even financially. Let's just talk emotionally. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I've listened to 2 or 3 conversations from people, and these people, generally speaking, come from great, stable marriages where they're like role models, okay? And I know there's like 75% of the guys out there that, and obviously 75% of the women, that are struggling with these issues.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, having been divorced myself and having had to work through a lot of that and the pain that I caused and all of that, it's not a pathway that I would recommend. On the other hand, I would not recommend the virtues of staying in a home. What's Willie Nelson says? There's worse things than being alone, like a house where nobody's home. That's not a model either.
Right.
Kids also need the model of their parents moving toward what is good and whole for them, even if it means divorce. But divorce always adds a special kind of requirement that you take care of that which you have helped break. And that we don't learn how to take care of the wounds that we cause. We're not good at that, so we don't know how to. We don't. First of all, we don't know how to repent. It's not a big notion in this society. It's almost like, you know, we say, I was thinking that this last week I would have liked to have talked about shame and guilt in a positive way. I mean, John Edwards and Strauss Kahn, they needed more shame and more guilt. And not this ritual apology like what's it, Wiener? I always want to call him Packer. Wiener had, oh, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm sorry. No, repentance. Really deep repentance. This comes out of a deep flaw in me, and I'm going to retire enough, and I'm going to deal with this flaw in myself. And then to deal with the shame, he should feel guilty. He should, you know, it's appropriate that he feels both guilty and shame, and that he goes from there to repentance, and from repentance to asking for forgiveness.
Uh-huh.
I mean, those are the paths of healing.
Great.
I don't know whether I answered your question. It was a pretty good answer, but was it to your question?
Actually, I didn't have James on the mic anymore. Just a sec.
Okay,
yeah. So we're actually at the end of our time. So, Sam, you are a very provocative thinker and truth teller. I really appreciate your perspective on the whole evolution of the men's movement, what works, what doesn't, where we really need to shift our focus to how to live from sacred power and to really serve and meet the challenges of our day. So thank you so much for this 45-minute journey we've been on.
Well, thank you for giving me a pulpit for this Sunday afternoon.
Great. And if folks want to connect with you more, I know you have a really robust website with lots of essays, and you just make almost everything available for free, samkeen.com. Anything you want to say?
Well, they can also buy all of my books or anything from that. If they want them autographed, just tell me. I'm a one-person operation. All this stuff is in my books one place or another, or tapes or whatever. And then I have an email like everybody, sam@samkeen.com.
Okay. Great. Well, actually, if
just don't send me manuscripts wanting me to edit them or publish them, please. or for the most part, poetry.
Poetry. One-page poems are welcome, right?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's been great, Sam. So thank you so much for your perspective and your hard-earned wisdom over the years, and I think that it's really been a blessing for all of us, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Other people have suffered a lot for whatever wisdom I've gained.
Great. Okay, well, have yourself a beautiful afternoon.
Thank you, and thank you for asking me to do this.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. So, as Sam drops off, we have the opportunity for about the next 25 minutes or so for people to connect in smaller groups. Our next panel is really going to be great, going deep into the heart of violence and war and the effect on men's bodies, minds, and souls with people really at the front lines. Ed Tick is a pioneer in post-traumatic stress disorder, and Luis Rodriguez is a gang intervention expert and lecturer and author. So they're really at the front lines of dealing with some of the worst kind of violence and damage that men face. And so it's going to be a good panel, 2:45. And if you want to stick around and connect with each other and discuss these great ideas and provocative concepts that Sam shared with us, happy to put you into small groups of three or four. So if you're a man and you'd like to stick around for a bit and connect with some other men, touch one. If you're a man or woman and want to be in a mixed group, you can touch two, and we're happy to put you in groups for a bit until the start of the next program in 25 minutes. And we'll try to give you a little announcement, but just so you watch the time, 2:45, we will bring you back into the main room. So thanks so much, and when the bell rings, you will be in your groups, and thanks for participating. Look forward to connecting on Facebook and elsewhere in the summit. Thanks a lot.